So I want to introduce. I appreciate you being here.
Thanks for having me. For those who don't know me, I'm Tim Toomey. I've been serving the community in Watertown since 1999. I'm with the police department, currently serving as the assistant chief. So thanks for coming and listening to me. Lee and the sheriff asked for our input on what are some of the concerns that we've been seeing as the police department at the jail and at the courthouse. I just want to start by applauding the sheriff's office. All the things I have here is negative, but it's an incredible task on a daily basis on what the job they do. So they do an excellent job there, and I can't speak highly enough about the jail staff or the sheriff's office. So I don't want any of this to reflect negatively on staff. It's just, it is what it is. So I'm just going to kind of blatantly honest on what our opinions are and not hold anything back. So let's first talk about the jail. And the booking area is one of the major concerns of ours. You know, we have to stay there with the inmate, and there's constant traffic going back and forth, whether it's work release, there's constantly people being interviewed, and drug tests and all sorts of stuff. So it's a really uneasy feeling when we're in there and you got who's who, you know, walking back and forth, and there's just not enough room in there. It's just not segregated. The booking is all together. It's a nightmare for us. It really is. It kind of puts a hair on the back of your head stand up when you're in there booking in somebody. So, you know, it's a safety issue not only for us, but also for the inmates. You know, you don't know who knows who. So we could have an inmate, you know, or an offender that we're arresting, have no idea that the inmate that's going on work release has a beef with them. And next thing you know, they're in a all-out brawl, and that puts us in danger and also the offenders. The sally ports, that's another major concern. They're awkward to get in. I would not confirm or deny that I might have hit that pole once or twice in my career coming in, but they're really awkward to get in. Again, if we have an aggressive offender, it's really no space in there to deal with them. It's just really, really dangerous, especially if you have two cars in there at once. I mean, there's just no room.
It's for everybody's understanding, the sally port is basically the garage that a law enforcement car pulls in to take a prisoner in from the right. Car to the jail, to the booking area.
Yep.
It's currently the size of a two-stall garage.
Yeah, if
basically.
That. Yep. So it's definitely a dangerous spot for us. And stop me if anybody has any questions. Feel free to shoot them out there. Interview rooms, just again, they're right off of where the booking process is. And they've done a good job with what the space they had, but you know, you can't get blood from a stone. And there's just a lack of technology. A lot of times we have to go back to the jail to interview people that are in custody there. So our only opportunity is to bring our own digital recorder, go into this room, right in the mix of everything. You know, there's noise going on out there. It's just not conducive to a good, solid interview with suspects. So that's another big concern of mine. The sides are terrible. There's not enough seats. I mean, there's chairs in there that could be used as weapons if an inmate got upset with us, which, believe it or not, they sometimes get upset with us. The lack of space. I just pointed out to Tom, just recently we had two brothers that we were investigating as a police department for methamphetamine, and we would have preferred them not to be together, but due to the lack of bed space, they had no choice but to put these brothers together. So, you know, that was a concern. The juvenile end of it is also a concern for us. But, you know, it's separated sight by sight and sound, and they do a good job with that, keeping the juveniles separated. But, you know, again, it's a small area, so how thorough are we being with that? So, I mean, even going in the front door, it's a nightmare for officers. I mean, you're right in there, people are coming in there for the 24/7 program. They're coming in after work release. You got people coming in for visitation. You have that small lobby and just no space, and it's just a matter of time, in my opinion, before somebody gets hurt. All right.
Hey, any questions from the committee on the jail as far as the police department? Any questions from anybody here about the jail?
And if I'm wrong, let me know that I'm wrong, because I could be opinionated sometimes.
That's what we want to hear. So.
All right. Courthouse. This has always been a concern. I mean, we constantly are talking about this. Let me first talk about just simply grand jury weeks. I had just recently calculated what one Grand jury costs our department for overtime because of the lack of space. You have two or three attorneys waiting to process cases for grand jury, and they happen now, I think, twice a month, if at least, if not more than that. And the reason they're doing that is trying to alleviate the overtime bill that the police department has. I calculated just in one grand jury, one afternoon, we had 7 to 8 officers there, and it cost the department $900 for that one day, just having officers sit there. They report in at 1:30, and sometimes they're just sitting there until 5 o'clock because they're waiting to testify because there's no other space. If we had space, they could probably make that system a lot better and save the city some money. So that's a concern.
I got a question.
Yes, sir.
Now you mentioned they might be sitting there so long. Now, if there's more space, what would they be doing? Would they be out of the job and then come back, or...
No, if there was more space, you know, you could have two grand juries going at once. I mean, there's other options.
Okay, space for the grand jury.
Yeah, I mean, and you never really know where you're going to be for grand jury because it's whatever's open at the time. Sometimes we're using the jury room up in the trial courtroom. Sometimes we're using the commissioner's room. Sometimes we're in the basement of the sheriff's office, wherever.
Who convenes the grand jury?
The state's attorney's office.
Why do they convene two at the same time?
They don't. They to schedule them all for like 1:30 to 5:30. And then there's different prosecuting attorneys for if it's a misdemeanor, you know, they assign them out. So
would that be a little bit more advantageous for your officers if they knew one case is going to be at 1 and another one at 4?
Yes. I mean, in a perfect world, that's how it sounds like it would be simple and reasonable to do that. But don't forget you're dealing with victims that have schedules. You have people showing up at different times. You know, the state's attorney can't sit there and have 10 grand jury members waiting because an officer is scheduled to 1:30, but, you know, it's quarter after 1, so they're just going to sit there. You know, it's just scheduling is difficult when it comes to grand jury cases.
It sounds like, I'm not super familiar with it, but it sounds like a lot like court scheduling, just scheduling a trial. It sounds pretty similar to that where you have all these
cases. Yeah, and they do a good job. I mean, and they're doing more each week, so I have to have less officers there at a time, but it's still more about the space. Because you never really know where you are. I mean, a lot of times they got to go wandering around the courthouse to find out where a grand jury is for that day because maybe there's a trial going on in that one and commissioners are using the other one or whatever.
Could you have a sign like we have in the hallway that he puts up?
Yeah, we could have a little volunteer, you know, walking everybody all
over. You have a sign, grand jury, leave over there. Or maybe you don't want it, you know it.
Yeah, it's just, again, I mean, I'm probably exaggerating a little bit that they don't get lost in the courtroom. Courthouse, they know their way around, but it's just just trying to demonstrate there's a lack of space there. Yeah. So anyway, bringing inmates in and out it's always a big concern, especially when you're walking them outside. I remember the Amatin murder, where Randy Cotton was murdered here in Watertown. That was my case, and it just terrified me that we're walking a murderer from the jail outside. Who knows who his friends are, you know, and then into the courtroom. It's just an obvious safety concern. And then you have to get them in the elevator and up to the courtroom. And there's just so many opportunities along the way for them to try to escape, try to, you know, have friends out there. It's a security nightmare. They're walking them past public, you know. A lot of times we have victim and suspect meeting up in the courtroom because there's nowhere to put them. There's no secure way to get the inmates into the courtroom. And additionally, we have all the inmates all sitting up in the jury box on a Tuesday courtroom. All the inmates are together, you know, and no place to securely hold them. So, again, the sheriff does a great job of keeping control of the security in the courtroom, but it's just a threat away from some bad things happening. Talked about the lack of space for grand jury, and... no security as for the public going into the courtroom. You know, most of the trials are public hearings, and you know, most of the time they have a jury or a jailer or a deputy out there wanting people. And you know, but it's still an average magistrate court. Anybody can walk in there at any time. And in today's world, with the active shooters and everything, you know, you never can be safe. You can't be safe enough. So.
I was just going to comment on that. But isn't it against the law to carry a gun in the courthouse?
Yeah, it's against the law to carry a gun in the school, too.
So that laws don't really help, do they?
No.
You know, it keeps the law abiding from, and then they're the ones that get shot.
Absolutely. That's a good point. Great point. So I'm open to any questions, and again, it's all negative. They do a lot of great things, but I don't think that's what we're doing here today, is to figure out what good things they're doing. We're here to see the needs of the county and the city.
Any questions from the committee?
You have
excuse me, Mr. Officer.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Any questions from the committee? Yeah, I just had one question on, kind of like along the lines with your grand jury, what you talked about there. If you're called, if an officer has to come in and testify just as a witness in a trial, I think I heard a comment on the radio once that sometimes the officer will just be sent away not having testified because that trial gets scrubbed.
We're scheduled. We're called into court normally on Tuesdays, or if it's your trial, you know, it's on a Thursday, and you just kind of put on standby and you're called in. And so many times where I got to pay my officers a minimum of 2 hours to come in. That's contract. They get paid 2 hours just to come in and show up and say, well, we had to reschedule that one, or, you know, it's not going to go, so we'll let you know next week, you know. So it's
Mr. Mack and then Mr. Hunt.
Assistant Chief Toomey, I'd like if you could maybe comment. According to the statistics that our consultant here has put together, it appears that the Watertown Police Department is probably responsible for 80 or 85% of the arrests. I'd just like your assessment or opinion. What is the criminal activity here in Watertown, say, compared to Brookings, Sioux Falls, Fargo? In your opinion, your estimation, you must communicate back and forth some. And, I know we're having drug issues and things, but could you just comment once where we're at compared
to? Yeah, thank you for the question. And I was visiting with Mr. Coyson in here a little bit ago. He has some statistics readily available there that he got off of the Attorney General's office. But we are seeing a huge increase in methamphetamines, and that's not only in this community, but it's statewide. And I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. One good thing that Cottonwood County has done is the drug court, you know, Cottonwood County drug court. But kind of the side effect of that is more population in the jail, because we're not sending them to prison anymore. So anytime they have a sanction, if we got a sanction, a lot of times we sanction one of the probationers to 7 days in jail. Say he failed a UA, or he didn't show up for his meetings at treatment. One of the sanctions, not all the time, but we will send him maybe 7 days in jail. So that's going to increase his population, and that's a side effect. But comparatively, we are about the same as Aberdeen. You know, 10,000 more people in Aberdeen than there are in Brown County than there are in Cottonwood County, but they're seeing the same thing we're seeing. So methamphetamine is a huge problem, and all the crime that's related to that. Yeah, I mean, my opinion is 80 to 90% of crime is related to drug or alcohol use. I mean, I think a reasonable person would agree with that. Whether it's the burglaries, the forgeries, the thefts, the assaults, it's all related to methamphetamine, or other drugs. I know heroin's knocking on the door. We've been hearing a lot of intel across the country. It's making its way through Wisconsin and Minnesota, and it's on our borders, and it's just a matter of time before it gets here. And with Senate Bill 70, as you know, we're not going to be able to send those dealers the offenders, they're not going to be going to prison. And whether you agree with that or not, it's what we're living with. So we need the jail space to address that. And me, being a member of the drug court, I agree with that. I mean, I've already seen the benefits of keeping them here locally, giving them the jail sanctions, keeping families together, keeping them tax-paying citizens out there working and doing the right thing. And there's a guy, when I signed up for a drug court, I was a cynic. There's never going to work. We need to send those guys to prison, because that's the only way they're going to get free of their drugs. And I could think of three of them right off the top of my head that I said, there's no way they're going to succeed. But thanks to the jail and thanks to the drug court team, they're succeeded. And we have two people that have over 300 days clean in our program. So it's an amazing thing, but it can't happen unless you have the bed space.
May I ask a follow-up to that?
Okay.
Real quick. The thing that I'm really curious about, because I've been researching a lot of these numbers too, for some reason, in proportion to our population here in Cottonwood County, we're jailing more than twice as many people as they are in Brookings County. We're at twice the level per population as they are in Fargo. And I know they've had a lot of criminal problems up there with the oil boom is kind of shut out that way. And I'm just really curious why we are running so much higher than in comparison.
I would be careful with the statistics, especially when it comes from another county. You know, it's called reporting to NIBRS or to the FBI. That's what we did. We're mandated to report all our offenses, all our arrests to NIBRS, which is National
Incident-Based Reporting System.
Incident-Based Reporting System, yeah. But there's nobody mandating what we put in there. So it's easy, not saying it happens, I'm not accusing, say, Brookings of under-reporting, but we've been looking at those same statistics because every year we do a yearly report, and it is alarming that, I mean, I know that crime's happening in Brookings. I mean, it's just, I just don't know why the numbers aren't reflecting that. And another thing you have to take into account, are those numbers including the University Police Department? I don't know if they do or not, but the University Police Department, I don't think is mandated to report the numbers, so I don't know. But
I just was primarily looking at jail population. I wasn't looking at arrests or anything else.
Yeah, you know, and we are a blue collar town. You know, if we have I consider Watertown a really safe place. I mean, I transplanted from New York to here, so you know, the numbers are one thing, but I believe that the Sheriff's Office and Police Department do a pretty good job keeping Watertown safe.
Thanks. Mr. Howell, did you have one question?
On these arrests that you're making and reports, is that report somehow getting to the gun control business and the guns, that people shouldn't have guns? Is there something in your process that these people get put on a list so that they are prohibited from purchasing guns?
Yes, if there's federal law prohibiting, you know, if it's a violent offense, they're prohibited from carrying a gun. If it's a drug offense, they're prohibited from domestic violence. They're prohibited from carrying guns. So,
does a gun dealer, is there a list someplace that they...
No, but everybody has to go through a background check. It's kind of a funny story is I won a gun just recently at the Elks raffle, and I went to Cohen's Corner to pick it up. It's just a shotgun. They put me on a delay. They wouldn't give me the gun. And, you know, and I carry a gun. I'm like a police officer. So, no, you're delayed. The FBI delayed you. Well, come to find out after doing some checking, it was because of my military secret clearance that I've just always been on this list. So I can't really comment about gun control. I mean, that's more of the feds. But if we find drugs in combination with guns, we definitely work with the ATF and prosecute those offenders.
And at the state level?
Yes.
Any questions from the committee or the Mass Public? Well, that was very useful. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
I really appreciate your coming. So.
If you ever need anything, let me know.
Yeah, I think this is probably, as we go through this some more, I think we're going to probably be coming back to the police department asking for a bit more detail, some more detailed observations. So that's very good. It gives us a good feel. Thank you. All right. So let's back up in the slides and hand it off to Mr. Gardos here. And we're still waiting on Carrie Johnston, so she should be here pretty shortly. So when Bill's done, we can let Carrie speak. So, all right, so what Bill is here to do is I sent out, he sent me the draft report. So this is just the first draft of the final report. And then he finished it over the weekend. So we got it on online. What you have in front of you on paper is just the conclusion because it's about 100 pages. And most of us have seen most of the charts and the graphs over the course of Bill speaking to us, and so he's gonna take us through the thing in the preliminary version, and we'll talk about where to go from there. So.
Thank you, Lee. I was concerned that you all had been missing all my charts and graphs, so I wanted to be sure to provide you with some more. Before getting into some of the updates that I wanted to show you and some of the issues that I've been struggling with, when I put together the draft report, I went back and checked. Remember we looked at all those criminal justice statistical indicators early on, one of our first meetings, we looked at crime, arrest, and criminal case filings. So as I was putting together the draft report, I went back to check, and I realized those only went through 2013, and now 2014's data is available. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, because we've already talked about it, but in the final report, I've added the 2014 data on those criminal justice statistical indicators so they'd be up to date. And interestingly, what I found was the total crime numbers were down last year from the year before by 13%. Arrests were also down 15% from the year before, but criminal case filings were up 25% from the year before and had new record high number of criminal case filings in Cottington County, both record high numbers of misdemeanor case filings as well as record high numbers of felony case filings. In just from 2013 to 2014, we had a 31% increase in felony case filings in court. And if you remember when we talked about some of these things, the correlation between crime and jail beds is pretty far. Arrests are a little, as are a statistical indicator that are a little closer to correlating with jail bed needs. But criminal case filings are even more so. You're further into the system, you're dealing with people that are within the criminal justice system at that point. So criminal case filings being up is a pretty significant indicator of support for continuing jail population increase, more so than the crime or arrest data. But that's all in there because I wanted you all to have that data available. As you know, reasonable minds can differ, so I put the data in there for everyone to have and draw their own conclusions from. But that's something that's an update from what we had talked about several months ago.
So that is that in the draft that's online? Okay,
yeah.
So that draft is online and that information is incorporated into the criminal criminal activity indicators?
Crime, arrests, and criminal case filings all have one more year's worth of data than when we looked at that back in, May or June, one of the first meetings.
Yeah. Yeah, the reason is I didn't print up the whole report because it's over 100 pages, so I'd save the county some paper.
But today what I wanted to just touch on was some of the things that I've been wrestling with is some of the updated inmate population trends and the updated projections from last time we talked about it. These are bookings every month at the jail from 2008 to present. And what you see in these last 3 months is we have hit a new record high number of monthly bookings, and last month hit the second highest level of bookings. Now remember, this is just the number of bodies coming through intake. They may be staying a few hours, few days, few weeks, few months, but just in terms of the numbers of people being processed into the jail, we're hitting record high spikes in the number of bookings in the last 3 months.
What constitutes a booking?
Anybody being arrested off the street, brought in, and booked in for a crime. It can be a new crime, it can be an old crime, it can be a warrant for arrest, any of the above.
But have been processed through the jail.
Run that by me again.
They can be arrested off the street for a new crime. They can be brought in.
Crime can be what?
Could be anything that's class 1 misdemeanor and above that requires custodial arrest. It could be a class 2 misdemeanor if they have not paid a fine or have not appeared in court, and now it's become either a bench warrant or an arrest warrant. So they can be arrested on warrants as well and brought in. Somebody who has got to check into jail, so they've been ordered by the judge to come into jail and check in. They are booked in when they come into the jail. All those constitute bookings.
I think the key thing to remember is all the rules about segregation, you just keep the different populations separated, apply in the booking area as they do in the incarceration area of the jail.
You're absolutely correct. Juveniles have to be separate from all other inmates. Males separate from females. Correct.
And that's one of the things we just heard from the police department is talking about the problems with the booking area. So this is where we're talking about the volume of people that are being brought into the facility and then subsequently released, maybe in a few hours, or they could be there for some time.
just in terms of the volume of people being brought into the jail, we're seeing the highest numbers we've ever seen. We can go to the next one. This is Cottington County's ADP at the detention center. This does not count the inmates being held for other counties. And in the last 3 months, as you can see on the graph, we have hit record high populations of Cottington County inmates in each of the last 3 months. We had 70 on average in July, 71 in August, and then 72 last month. So for the last 3 months, we have hit record high average daily populations of Cottington County inmates. And that's, of course, what has messed up trying to run the projections. We got 93 months worth of data here, and those last 3 months have helped to tip that trend line up a little bit, but not a lot. They are clearly huge spikes, and it's not just a single spike, but for 3 months we have had a glut of Cottington County inmates that this facility has never seen before. And on the next one, I took a look at the inmates we're holding for other jurisdictions to see is it other inmates that are filling this up, or is it Cottington County's? And you can see we've been sitting at about 8 inmates being held for other jurisdictions each of the last 3 months. So it's not the other county's inmates, it's Cottington County's that are filling up the jail right now and for the last 3 months.
Maybe the sheriff could have. I'm looking at it.
If you have a question, please raise your hand. I'll try to keep an eye.
So, I did raise my hand.
Okay. Let me recognize you, please.
You recognize?
Yeah. Okay, I'm the chairman. So, did you have a question, Mr. Hall?
I do.
Okay. Go ahead.
For the sheriff, I think, on the statute it says one of the your policies and procedures.
Okay. Is this about, can you please, if we can hold off on that, if that's not a question about specific to what the agenda is.
I think it's right pertinent to what we're working
on. Okay, please get to the point very quickly.
And that is that to provide classification of prisoners by sex, age, crime, and mental illness.
Yeah.
Is there a record of all this someplace? All those people that you're talking about you're putting in jail, is there a classification?
Mr. Hahn, if I could answer that, I think we talked about that in the snapshot that we did a couple, the last time Mr. Morales was here.
Was it month of August?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I looked. It took a day in time and said and just showed all the, I think it was about August 11th or
that
something.
That was the pie-shaped thing?
It was all those, mm-hmm. showed all those different breakdowns.
That was for one day?
Yep. And that the reason he was able to do that one day is he could save, you know, Mr. Walter and his folks in the jail.
So my question is, is there a record someplace of all of these you're talking about that they're classified by sex, age, crime, and mental illness? So that I could, somebody that was put in jail, say, 6 months ago, is there a record someplace that you could?
Well, okay, is that something we can answer very quickly?
Well, every time somebody's booked in and they put into a cell block, we've got a computer software system that we plug them into a bed and they're documented as far as where they are in the cell block, what cell block, even down to what bed they're in. And so then...
By sex?
Well, of course.
By age?
Males are here, females are here, juveniles are here, crimes they committed are here. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Sentence, so unsentence.
I asked you for that information about 6 months ago. I don't see it.
Okay, well, we need to move. Yes, this, okay, this is something we can handle after the meeting. Please,
I asked you for it too, Your Honor.
I don't know if you asked me
for
that.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
We can go ahead.
Yeah.
The next one.
Are we on that one?
Total, yeah. And so this has been the total. This is adding together both those inmates being held for other counties as well as Cottington counties. And again, the last 3 months, we have hit record high total inmate populations in the detention center. We hit 78 in July, 79 in August, and 80 last month. So remember, those are averages. So it was an average daily population of 80 inmates last month. And you can see that it's
since 2008, those numbers are higher than anything we've hit before. So, but we know that it's the Coddington County inmates that are causing the spikes in the last few months.
So the thing to point out, just for everybody's clarification, so this is the total ADP of the jail. The previous two slides broke out Coddington County versus other jurisdictions.
That's it.
Mm-hmm. I just have a quick little question. On these last three graphs, you had 73 for the Coddington County's inmates, and then over here on other jurisdictions, mm-hmm. you have about 8, I think, and 73 and 8 comes out to 91.
No. It's 72 plus 8 comes up to 80. But remember, all of these go down to multiple decimal points. I just don't like talking about 80.1 inmates. Yeah, all of them are rounded. Because we're taking prisoner days and then dividing it by the days of the month. But I hate showing partial inmates.
Understood. Thank you.
And that's why you'll see the dots on the graph will be slightly different, but the same number, like on the other county graphs, are 8. But one may be 7.9, one's 8.0, one's 8.1. So then the last one that you'll be familiar with is this is the high and low graph. We can go to the next one, Lee. Remember here, we have plotted the high and low population each month. We know that it fluctuates. And this is showing the highest one-day population each month and the lowest one-day population each month. And again, over the last 3 months, we have had the highest peaks in population at the detention center that we've ever had. We had a peak of 89 for a daily population in July. We had 86 in August and 88 in September. It was the highest one-day population. I think there's even been occasionally a count above that. But when we do a daily, it's the average of 4 counts taken during that day. So we have hit, you know, not only highest numbers on average for the month, but even the occasional one-day spikes have been higher than anything we've dealt with before. If you look at that trend line on the top, that is our trend line to the high peaks. And the low last month was higher than the trend through all our high peaks from 2008. I mean, these are significant spikes in the numbers for a facility of this size. So that's what we've been trying to, that's what I've been wrestling with, trying to develop projections, because it throws off all the math models. And you know that these are real bodies in custody that you have to provide accommodations for. And that's been obviously the challenges for the sheriff and the jail, not my inmate population projection models. So last time, I think when I had first developed projections, was when I think the first spike came and threw everything out of whack. I've run 4 different models on the inmate population data. I looked at rate of incarceration, number of inmates you got locked up per 1,000 county residents. I took a look at just the second model being just average daily population, that trend line to the averages going out from 08 to 2015. If that keeps going the way it has, where are we headed? The new model that I developed was just based on the last 5 years. And I took just literally the last 5 years worth of months and ran a trend line to see if it continues to increase the way it has over the last 5 years, and that has created an even steeper model just using the more recent data. And then the last one was average length of stay, where we took a look at the actual average length of stay based on the population and the number of bookings from 08 to 2014. And if that length of stay continues and the trend in bookings continue, where does that say we're going to end up? And so those are the models that I ran, and then I also did an average of all 4 of them. And we can show this is the complicated one. These are the different model results. Now on the left, the dark side shows those monthly average daily population numbers. That's actual. And when you run the models out,
you can see kind of that, I think when they were talking about the last hurricane, they called that the cone of uncertainty or something. And that's kind of where we're at, is you can see the models that are creating high and low ranges. Models 2 and 4 got fairly close toward the middle, and then I calculated the midpoint and ran it through the middle. And it's that midpoint basis that I've been using for my projections. And yet you can see we've already had, you know, the last 3 months have exceeded the 10-year midpoint projection. And it did tip the numbers up a bit, but not enough. So I can't tell you you need, you know, the numbers 10 years out based on that midpoint, because you've already dealt with inmate populations above that. So regardless of what the math models are showing, you know, we got to deal with the reality of the inmate population that we're dealing with. What I didn't want to do is I wanted to show you all of this information so that you have it and can make good decisions from it. You know, I could tell you that model 3C is the one that makes the most sense because it runs it up the highest and first, but there's really no correlation or statistical value to that model that the other ones don't have. I'm putting them all out there for you to see, but the reality is the models aren't supporting what you've been hitting over the last 3 months. Okay? And so now these are the numbers. You see those midpoint ADP projections hitting 70 inmates by 25 years, 77 in 10. And then remember, we added in that peaking factor and the classification factor to figure out how many beds we're going to need so that we have enough wiggle room to separate males from females, inmates at minimum, medium, and maximum security, and we can divvy them up into different housing areas. And this is how the math was coming out using those midpoints of the projection model.
Oh, now, you want a pointer?
Nah, I'm all right. This year, even though we've had three big spikes, we've had a total average daily population for the first 9 months of the year of 68. So when you think about it in terms of what we've had so far for the year, you know, the models don't appear to underestimate it too badly, but when you've been dealing with the huge spikes that you all have had for the last 3 months, you've got to take that into account when you decide how large a facility you want to try to tell architects to put together for you, if that's what you decide to do. And so another way to look at it, and it's the last slide, fortunately, you see the historical average daily population. That's annual. We're not talking month by month anymore. That's an annual total for average daily populations at the detention center. I ran those midpoint projections out. You add in peaking factor, you add in classification factor, and what it's telling us is, you know, 5 years you need a facility of 88 beds, 10 years, 97 beds. Knowing that you've already hit 89 inmates on a certain day, you've had 80 on every given day in the last month. So I was wrestling with whether to try to continue to manipulate the models to get them to come up with results that make sense in reality, or to just present it all, put it on the table, and show you. And so that's what I decided to do. When I started working on the projections a few months ago, it seemed to me that, you know, the key question here, besides do we need a new jail, is if we do, how big ought it be? And I was thinking we are looking at something in the 100 to 120 bed range to build something that's going to last the county for at least 10 years based on the projections, and that will accommodate the 10% that you hold for other jurisdictions. I was thinking we need to be looking in the 100 and 100 to 120 bed range, which is still supported by the projection. But given your last 3 months spikes, I really think if you were looking for a recommendation, you need to be looking more in the 120 to 140 bed range, because you don't want to have to go through this exercise, build it, and then be full very quickly after you've opened. And so whether I can get the math to work out or not, that's what the data is telling me. But I wanted to make sure that all the data was there in case it's telling you something.
Are those bed required?
One second. Any questions from the committee? Mr. Hunt.
the bed requirement, is that a direct correlation to bookings?
No, to average daily population it is.
Yeah.
It's correlated with that. Because the bookings, some of those people may be out in a few hours, some of them may be there for days, weeks, months.
So there could be twice as many bookings as bed requirements for the same day.
Yeah. But this makes
so
it
then,
work. Go ahead.
What can you tell me that's different over the last 3 months up to that point that we went from here to here? Is there any data or?
I have no data to tell you why we hit those three spikes. And I don't know that I could find the answer for you in the data. But maybe the sheriff
this is a question we kind of all wonder, like what's going on these last 3 months. And maybe I'll just say this kind of my view of things, but and then let anybody comment on the committee. But I think it's, for one, kind of hard to tell. The challenge is that when you say to a sheriff's office or a jail, okay, now you need to track this data. Well, that's when you're starting to deal with those details and then start tracking it and having trends and looking at that, like, okay, now we're seeing somebody, you know, all these, this kind of felony or this kind of misdemeanor is now showing up in our jail, or this kind of arrest or, you know, this, you know, is getting incarcerated pretrial or whatever the thing is, that is actually quite a bit of work. And so, yeah, the data is there, but crunching it is kind of the challenge. And so that's the tricky part. And a lot of the speculation is, as Assistant Chief Toomey was talking about, was with meth. And then the other speculation, of course, is SB 70, so the Public Safety Improvement Act. And just for everybody's edification, we had a few meetings ago, we had one of the court services officers talk about the impact of SB 70 upon probation, the life of a court services officer. But and we got a little bit of how that impacts the jail, because you have those timeouts, those sanctions that a court service officer can administer. But also, there's the other half of it is judges now are limited in their sentencing of who goes to the penitentiary. And so, therefore, one would presume that some of those people that were going to the penitentiary are now showing up in the jail for their sentences. And so that's the trick. And sitting down and crunching that is kind of, that might yield something, but that's going to take a lot of work. That's kind of my take on it. And then setting up the mechanism to track all that is the challenge. So is that a fair
thing? That's extremely fair. I've been in the business for almost 20 years now. I don't believe that there's any gauge that's going to give anybody here an answer as far as what we have seen just over the last 3 months. I can tell you it's a number of factors. I believe it's a number of factors all culminated that makes it. I do know that we've got a police department that's fully staffed and has been fully staffed. I've got a sheriff's office that's fully staffed. And our highway patrol has been fully staffed, I want to say now, for at least the last year or better. You got good officers making very good arrests and doing an excellent job stamping out criminal activity. So, number one. Number two, we've got a rise in methamphetamine-related incidents. Officers on the street are finding methamphetamine as often or as easily as I found marijuana when I was a rookie officer on the street. So we've got that in our along with this as well. One other factor that Tom and I see is the amount of arrest warrants. And I put this one on the fact that, just like Assistant Chief Toomey said, the court system lacks space. Court cases continue to get backlogged. People who are out on bond or pending court sentences, arraignments, any of the processes that go along with court, have charges hanging over their heads for longer periods of time. And they're not getting resolved in a timely basis. They're committing new crimes on top of those. So we've got multiple charges and multiple offenses on the same individual who now might end up in our custody eventually and back in the jail. So so it's not uncommon for us to have somebody in our custody six to seven different files at seven different times for criminal activity that has taken place, and they've found themselves in the court system for well over a year or even longer. When I see over the last number of years our arrest warrants and bench warrant numbers go from, I want to say 700 to 800 when I got into office, to last year was over 1700, that goes along with the court volume. Court system gets backed up. So take all those into effect, and that's what we're seeing.
What's a bench warrant again?
Bench warrants issued from the judge from the bench. Somebody fails to appear in court. They fail to pay a fine. They fail to pay their attorney's fees. They fail to pay restitution ordered. They fail to abide by any court-appointed or court order of the court, whether it's treatment or whether it's classes through human service agency. If they fail to follow through, bench warrants get issued.
Okay. That's kind of the elephant in the room question. So, Mr. Mack.
I sympathize with all that. There are some issues, though, I think, in bail procedures, things like this, or there are things like that that are loading up the system here versus other places. The other concern that you've got, and I hate to bring it up, is you're building something long-term for the future. It's no different when I go out and buy a piece of equipment or build a building on that farm. I've got to anticipate what my needs are in the future and where the trends are going. Well, one of the trends that we're looking at is at some point in time it appears marijuana is going to be decriminalized. The other one that we're looking at is criminal justice reform is a big issue. You've got the Koch brothers and ACLU both pushing for major revisions in criminal justice, and a lot of that is getting nonviolent offenders out of jails. So these are issues that are coming down the line. Is this a temporary spike? Is this going to be a long-term trend? Or is it going to be something we need for a little while and then no longer need?
That's the question. But in line with the incarceration alternatives and, you know, you're talking about the pretrial assessments and things like that. Those are things that are in the works in the justice system. And, you know, as this process goes through, obviously we have to take that stuff into account. And one of the reasons we're trying to understand all this, that's one of the reasons that Human Services is here. And that's one of the reasons we have the court service officer come and tell us about SB 7. And we're going to continue. I'm trying to understand it at this point, diversion programs, all those kinds of things. And so, you know, as policies change, yeah, there might be something that we can try to account for. It is very hard to do, obviously, without an empirical data set. But you can try to, go ahead and push it on my.
The interesting thing, I mean, nobody can play God here. That's probably the only person that comes up with that almighty answer. But I've been listening to the sheriff for 3 years, been saying the same thing over and over. You're seeing more and more violent crimes. You're seeing more and more juveniles doing higher offense crimes. Mr. Garnos, who just comes in the picture 6 months ago, reviews the stats for the last 8 years, says, what was it, 31% is the increase in felonies.
Yeah.
It's more and more violent crimes. That is obviously one of the factors that's driving this. And the fact is a year ago, and we went through the process of trying to propose the election option, we said we needed 150-cell jail. There's the data. It hasn't changed.
Thank you. That's kind of the realize we're not going to resolve the issue. This is kind of, we're getting into the philosophical world now, but we do have to keep an eye on things. So on the report, since we have, this is preliminary draft, but I think, tell me if this is the next steps. You have the whole thing online, members of the committee, and it's also available for the public to take a look at it if you'd like. It's on the Academy County Justice Advisory Committee website. If you get back to me between now and the next meeting, or actually sooner the better, if you have any comments or questions, if you have any right now from anything you've looked at, this is an opportunity to ask Mr. Garner's. But then we want to take this, get this finalized, so we can take the next step. So any questions specific to the report? There's some recommendations in there. You have the conclusion part in front of you. Talks a lot about building basically an assessment of the current facility, which kind of leads us to the point that those are the issues that we want to fix in a new facility or remodeled or renovated facility. And then he talks about the recommendation, the size recommendation, kind of like you just reflected to us. One of the other things that I noticed is that we need to, the data tracking is kind of going to be a challenge, I think, into the future. If that's something, and that's something that we have to upfront say what, and that's kind of a burden on the county right now. And so, how do we do that? And that's a challenge. So. Okay. Any other questions? Anything else from Mr. Garner?
The only other thing I would say is I wanted you to all have all of this data, but you don't need to decide now or next month the right size for a new facility if you decide that. That's not a decision you have to make right now. By the time you have to make that decision of how big a new facility would need to be, we're going to be a few months down the road, and you'll be able to tell whether those spikes we've been dealing with for the last 3 months were just, you know, part of the normal zigzag of the inmate population going up, or if it continues, you know, that's the type of thing you need to take into account when you make a decision on how big a new facility needs to be. The bigger it is, the more expensive it's going to be. And so you have the data, you've seen the factors that I have used and analyzed to come up with it, but you don't have to decide tonight, or the commission doesn't have to decide next month, that we need a jail with X number of beds. And so I think when you have to make that decision, you'll have a little bit more information to have a greater comfort level on whether those three spikes have been an aberration and a summer peak, or if there's something new that the counties have been going to have to deal with one way or another.
All right. Thank you.
The questions I've asked you for this information, from my point of view, spike, okay, it's there. Why is it there? What are the new law that's been passed? Or is there something we're not doing in the community that we should be doing? And these other things, I don't know, rising up, what's the age group, put all that stuff together. And maybe some of these people that are ending up in jail should be going through another channel of some sort within the community.
That's the point of, that's the initial thing that SB 70. The Public Safety and Improvement Act is trying to get to, but as a result of that, you know this is the debate. We're not going to solve this problem tonight. But what that has done, what the idea was, that you get inmates out of the state system, out of the penitentiaries, and then get them into the local systems, be it probation with court services officers or into a jail. So obviously figuring out, you know, the hard numbers of that's the trick. And so that's something that it's going to be a burden on any county to try to figure out how to do that. So, but I don't want to cut you off. We can talk more after the meeting about this, but we're not going to solve it right now. I do want to get to the next item on the agenda. We have with us Carrie Johnston from Human Services Agency and Sarah Peterson's in the audience from our welfare office. And just to update everybody, you might have seen this in the minutes from the county commissioner's minutes from probably about a month ago. We began a permanent presence in the jail with a mental health professional. So we have a person there that's doing 20 hours a week in the jail, and we're already seeing some benefit from that. But I think what Carrie's here to do is kind of give a perspective from on the jail from the Human Services Agency, from the viewpoint. And then, yeah, if you have any observations about the facility, but the main thing we want to do is gain a grip on, what is going on there. So.
I'm Carrie Johnson. I'm the Chief Operating Officer of Behavioral Health with the Human Service Agency, and I've been with HSA for 15 years, so I've worked very closely with our corrections officers and the detention center, and doing evals down at the jail and such. We recently started the position, thanks to Sarah and her hard work, of looking at the Stepping Up initiative of having a counselor in the jail 20 hours a week. And I do think, and I know Toby and Tom could probably speak a little bit more to the efficacy of it because they're in it every day, but I think that's been very helpful to ascertain what the needs are of the inmates, make any recommendations that they might in terms of their long-term care, helping with the severe persistent mentally ill population that we have in the jails, and then also with follow-up care. We're definitely trying to make sure that what they are managed once that they are released from jail, continuing in services, continuing on medications, and that kind of thing. To speak to your point, sir, though, about are there other community resources that we can put some of the people, the criminals, into versus putting them in jail? We definitely have made strides in that regard. Senate Bill 70 introduced us to what's called CIVISA, which is a form of cognitive behavioral intervention for substance abuse groups for people that have class 5 and 6 felonies. They participate in our treatment groups, and that has been very successful, and we have seen a lot of individuals go through that treatment group, and it's a different form of treatment than we're used to. However, we still need some kind of sanctions, or the court service officers do, when people just don't follow that recommendation. When people just don't come to treatment, they just don't follow what they need to do, generally those sanctions are put them in jail. And so it is hard when that jail is full, because we can't make someone come to their designated treatment. The secondary form of that would be the drug courts. We've had drug court up and running for, you probably all talked about this in previous meetings, but that too has been helpful. That has taken pressure off prisons is what it's done. It's been pressure on the local resources, though, because again, if they continue to use or if they continue to not follow recommendation of their drug court team, there's not much that we can do. There has to be some kind of sanction. We can't just keep giving them chance after chance. I'm a second chance person all the way around. However, when they continue to offend and continue to offend, our options are limited in that regard. So that does put pressure on the jail because we don't know what else we can do with them at that point. But we are ramping up as many community resources as we can to help with this population as well. Now with Senate Bill 76 with juveniles coming through, it's going to be the same kind of thing. We're going to have to look at what do we have in our community that can help with the resources for those kids too, so they don't get sent away to out of home placements, because that's not going to be an option anymore. I have witnessed a lot of mentally ill population being detained at the jail, whether they have criminal charges or because they're being held before we get to an evaluation. And it's been unpleasant for, I think, everybody involved. The person who's mentally ill doesn't necessarily understand what's going on. They think they're on legal charges. They're not. They're just being probably too combative. We just had one this week. Too combative to have at our safe room. It was a little aggressive. It took a couple officers to get him into. He was delusional. He thought the FBI were listening to him and his conversations. And unfortunately, in addition to what's going on lately here in 3 months with the spike in jail, I can tell you that the spike is happening everywhere. Down at the Human Services Center for State Hospital, they are full. And for the first time in the 15 years that I have been here, they're saying there's no room at the end. You can't send us your involuntary commitments any longer. So then we've been at work with Avera. Avera said that they are full. So my staff is calling me saying, I've got this guy at the jail who is kicking and screaming and causing kind of a ruckus because he thinks the FBI are listening to his conversations. And Yankton is telling me they're full, and Avera is telling me they're full. And what can we do with them? And we were thinking as outside of the box as we can, but he was aggressive and assaultive and had threatened to shoot a firearm before he came in, or he maybe even did shoot if there was a question about firearms. So we couldn't just let him go. We had to figure out what to do. Thankfully, that story is HSC discharged a few people that day, and they were able to take him later in the day. But that person was detained in the drunk tank, I believe, all day. And so it's very not a safe environment, really, for him to be in either, not anything that would be calming to someone who's witnessing or experiencing a mental health crisis, and they don't have the staff to have to attend to that person banging on the door all day. The counselor that we have down there could definitely help on that assessment. In fact, he's the one who called me and said, I'm not sure what to do with this person. We can't hold on to them any longer than 24 hours because that state statute that we only have 24 hours to ascertain what we're going to do and act on that plan. So I definitely think when we look at a new facility, having something that would be sound, safe, secure for somebody that is not going to be, that is in that situation, so it's not going to be a big problem for the jailer staff to attend to that those needs all the time. And it's disruptive to the other, you know, inmates as well, I would say. Sir, what are you seeing in terms, and you guys kind of chime in terms of having our counselor at the jail? I feel like it's been a success. He has reported back that he's busy from the minute he gets there to the minute he comes to the office, and we've done a lot of case management back and forth and a lot of communication about what to do with this person, following up with this person. I don't know, what are the jail staff saying and seeing?
I think they're pretty pleased with the program. Getting these people a resource that we didn't have before. And, you know, you guys are busy at the agency, so it's not just call you up and say, hey, we've got this guy here, can we bring him down? You know, that ties up your agency, ties up one of Toby's deputies, so it's helping us on our end. Yeah, it's far safer for everybody. And another plus that I've seen is, you know, we have our contract jail doctor that comes in, deals with medical issues. Sometimes these mental health issues and medical issues across the paths, and it's been a big benefit because on the mental health side, he's been able to take a look at their medications and say, you know, we probably should back off on this one because that's not helping the situation. It's making it worse. And then that communication, and then they're communicating, he's communicating with the doctor, and it's been beneficial.
Anybody comment, sir?
As like Carrie said, this is part of the national initiative, the Stepping Up initiative, and we are at the very beginning stages, but we're making very, very successful, very prominent headway for a rural county. I think one of your biggest challenges with the rural county is you still have to provide the same resources as a larger county. You still have to deal with the same things. But some of the things I've seen, too, is when you get that pathway to success, and the counselor that we have is doing a really, really good job to connect them to that, whether it's their medication or whether it's the housing, you know, Maslow hierarchy of needs, you've got to get calmed down enough that they can even address those. And so we have that happening. And so definitely the counselor gained some space, some ability to do some case management, you know, with a phone line or helping them with those applications so that they, the individual inmates have access to that. But that pathway to success, they have that opportunity. They have to work on it, and they choose the pace. They choose whether they're going to. It's not like that they get to manipulate that or anything. But that is going to help. The idea behind that is to help reduce that recidivism. You know, and this focus is definitely on mental illness. We're so at the beginning. We're just starting to get our data to determine how many are mentally ill. There's a higher percentage of people with mental illnesses that have a substance abuse disorder. You know, the general population is about 8%. Those in jail is 64%. So we have to identify what are those treatments and also identify what could be the space needs that the jail could use to help with those rehabilitation programs. We're looking at, you know, some interactive journaling, but we're so at the beginning, we can't even tell you. The average population is about 25% of people have mental illnesses that are in the jails. You know, can we get them out? Can we get them what they need? But they still have to be the ones to take those. We still have to keep them, the community, safe. So, you know, definitely making some headways, but we've also find too that people with mental illnesses on a national average spend longer time in jail than those who do not. And that can vary significantly, but you look at, you can see some individuals, like in Salt Lake County, a person without a mental illness spends an average of 22 days. A person with a severe mental illness spends an average of 46 days. So this is definitely kind of addressing what I've been hearing a lot of comments about is, what are we doing for these individuals? And I think, you know, it's a lot of co-occurring, and I think this will hopefully help. But these programs take a long time to develop. As far as rural county, on our national level, right now, we're very fortunate in our county to have a human service agency. Without them, you talk about the population spiking, I would anticipate it would be even higher, because we have access locally. So having them to be able to work with an agency is fantastic, but even just for them to have some space to be able to have the room to bring their services, it saves the sheriff's time and all that, I think is significant. But a lot, we see a lot of places, it takes 2 to 5 years to develop from the time we start to where we're at. Thankfully, to the support of, we've got a great board of commissioners that are very solution, you know, oriented and looking at, we've made some great strides. So, you know, very, very, we are so fortunate to have Human Service Agency, because if we didn't, I think even the jail, what you're seeing, you'd see a higher spike as well. So it's all new. It's there's a lot of unknowns. The one great thing is we don't have to pave the path first. We can follow some other examples, and we are working really closely with our NACO level to do that. So
NACO is the National Association of County Officials.
Okay.
I have a question too. So if you look at the benefits I'm hearing of doing this, it's a bit more orderly in the jail, because it allows the jailers to more focus on their typical line of work as corrections officers, as jailers, and they can then have the mental health professional to help them out with the issues that are specific to that. But it's also getting some better care for those you mentioned, the medication issues, the, you know, the different, you know, treatment plans or pathways or whatever. The big question though is are we, do you think we're seeing already a reduction in a few people that would otherwise be in the jail? And this is, I don't want to make you speculate if you're uncomfortable with it, but that's kind of the thing we're, I think, hoping for. But
I don't know that answer right now. I see promise for it down the road, though, because what I've learned by having Sean in the jail is that there's a lot of room for case management. And I do feel like this position could grow once into doing more case management and working closely with the judges and the court service officers so that we could reduce the daily population. For an example, there was a 16-year-old client of mine that was walked away from school in a different county, drank, was oppositional, got into a fight. Judge detained her for X amount of time. She goes to court. The mom asks for a court-appointed attorney. She's detained again. She spent 6 weeks in our jail, not going to school. She's on an IEP, so she couldn't really learn on her own. And they could not be released until she got before the judge again. And so what I would like to hopefully could happen with the position is they could work case management, talking with the judges, talking with court service officers, saying, let's put her on a home arrest. I've evaluated the home. We know the family. We're going to do whatever we can to surround her with our community supports so that she could go home. Otherwise, 6 weeks in jail doing nothing, went before the judge, got 4 months probation and released. So it could have been done a lot sooner.
That's,
but like, totally
compliment what she's saying. I'm going to push that with the program ongoing, because I've seen developmentally disabled persons that have been in our custody for long periods of time.
Mm-hmm.
Had they been identified as developmentally disabled early on, we could have dramatically reduced the amount of bed time, amount of days spent incarcerated. So as we push forward with this program, that's going to be my main focus, is to make sure that our counselor stays right on track with the state's attorney as far as when the charges come in and doing evaluations on it.
Like you
much
pointed,
quickly, much
right.
more quick basis.
Like you pointed out already, though, one of the big caveats is that the docket is full. So she gets before the judge, then there's this long wait leg before she gets before the judge again. And so in the meantime, it's nothing but a body in a cell. I mean, doing nothing. There's no rehabilitation. There was punitive consequence for skipping school for 3 hours. She got 6 weeks. And so it could be a better system. And I believe, and I hope Saratoga and Tom agree, that the position we have there is the position that's suited to do just that, and that would require a better office. You know, he uses his cell phone now when he gets reception in that area. We were able to work with HSA to get with our IT staff to get the computer up and running, and we do have the clinical document, you know, with our EHR, so that part is good. But aside from that, we could really do better things with that, I think.
Can I comment?
Yeah, please.
As far as that, just adding to that, what they're saying is very true. We're just beginning to start. We got to work with our state's attorney. We got to work with the judge, because the judge is going to be our leverage. But we're and I've had the conversation today, and I haven't even gotten to follow up with the rest of the individuals. We've got some screening tools that we can take a look at that will easily do a screen to identify the severe mental illness, mental also the risk assessment. So we can get kind of the low-risk people for reoffending. There are programs out there that can tell you what their risk at reoffending and what their crime is. And so we can take a look at some of those low-risk to offend and lower classifications of crimes and get them connected. And that is the whole idea of that program. So that should help then reduce the number of days. But like I said, we are just so at that beginning point that we're even now just trying to identify what is that population that's in there who have a mental illness, who have a severe mental illness, and then just working with the judges, you know, and finding out, you know, who are you mad at versus, you know, or who are you mad at versus who is not safe? You know, we want who should be in that jail, who don't belong into there, you know. As a county, in order for the programs to continue to stay, where are the savings? What's our fastest turnaround? And those are some of those things we're looking at, definitely. And then just implementing those the best that we can. It'll take, if the council does it, about 30 minutes per booking to identify those, but it'll be worth it. Just what I see in a reduction is if you can get them on that medication, especially the producing what's called, you know, the delusions, the causes that combativeness, you're going to help with that person. If they don't get those services before they're released too, we're probably going to see them again. So we're trying to really work in, but really at the beginning. But I absolutely think this will help reduce the numbers of days. But that then would be your discussion. Talk about I always think of that with the Senate Bill 70. If more people are going to be at your local level, what space do you need for programs for rehabilitation while they are in the jail? What's your average length of stays? Do you need classrooms? Can you help them with skills so that they can get jobs? Those are things that you want to, I see that you want to take into consideration for space. So for example, when I look at it, if you built it too big and then you don't need those spaces, I think they could be definitely utilized for something else that would benefit those that are there. You could turn that into, whether some places use a culinary school, you know, the way those pods are. That's what other counties in the other states have done. They take that space and utilize it to then put into the rehabilitation program. And we all benefit when individuals rehabilitate.
I don't really want to look at a culinary consultant, but one second, Mr. Allen. Question for Mr. Quiston.
Yeah, I was just wondering, it seems like it's a good program. It's very, like you said, promising and so on, but I was wondering, how long will it take before we know kind of the long-term benefits that we're deriving from this? In other words, people that are not repeat offenders, people that were in there but they got out through the program and they stayed out. Do you have any idea, you know, will it be 6 months or 3 months?
That's a good question. You know, I would say we're going to need at least 3 months just to gather the current data. One thing I'm personally working on right now is trying to get where we can get some better data to go back and track. Getting, you know, they've got lots of ideas on a national level to pursue on how to get someone to come in and do those stats at no cost. So that's what we're looking at, because we really want to track that. Are they following through? If they're not, have they been seen in the community before? Is this the first time? Is this their first initial contact to even know that they have a mental illness? So that we can know if there is that community resources. I would say at least a year before we really have a good handle. We're not going to know if we're reducing the number of days till we know how many are mentally ill, how many days are they staying. We don't have the comparison. We have the national averages. We don't have anything local. And to really get a good number, I'm going to say at least a year.
I would say at least that. Sometimes even longer, because we're looking at rate of reoffending. You know, they're in jail for X period of time, then they get out there on probation, so they can keep it together. They might not reoffend until they're done with all of that first legal charge, then they're living clean for a while, and then it happens again. That's at least what I see in my counseling practice, that it's, you know, maybe every year, every other year that they might reoffend, and if we're able to keep them, you know, get them out of the gates in a more healthy fashion, then we can sit here.
Any other questions from the committee? Any questions, Mr. Arnold?
Rehab centers, that part of this jail thing? Or?
As a research,
I don't know what they mean by rehab centers. Are called rehab centers, halfway houses, that type of thing.
Is that all part of this? A rehab center in the state of South Dakota, we have Keystone in Canton, we have the HSC in Yankton, we have Worthmore, which is a day program in Aberdeen on this side of the state, and that's really it for residential drug and alcohol treatment facilities. It's 29 days stay at best, maybe covered by insurance if you have it. If you don't have it, there's a bed wait to get state funding for that. We have one halfway house in Mitchell, and then we have that has 45 beds and a halfway house here in Watertown for 15 men that have a dual diagnosis. And then there is two halfway houses in Sioux Falls, I believe. Generally, they're at full capacity.
Who runs those?
They're all different. HSA has Serenity Hills. Dakota Counseling has Stepping Stones in Mitchell. Carroll Institute and Glory House have two of them in Sioux Falls. So they're all different nonprofit organizations generally. Keystone is a for-profit entity, I believe. And so,
I do have one quick question, Mr. Chair. I'm going to put you on the spot. These are comments that you've made to me in the past throughout our professional career. And you're not hurting my feelings again, because remember this jail was built. This jail was built when I was born. Okay. So I'm working with what's been given. Describe for me the conditions that you feel these persons are in when they come in a mental health crisis or are on a mental hold, and we've got them held in either our detoxification cell or our confinement cell, which are the only two options that we have in our current facility for these persons. When you come in and evaluate them, describe for the folks here what your professional opinion is of those environments in a therapeutic sense.
There's absolutely nothing therapeutic about it. It is traumatic, I would say. Even for a person who's committed a crime, maybe traumatic, but definitely traumatic for someone who is just being held in a mental health hold. In the drunk tank, it is just cement. I mean, that's all there is to it. And I can't do an eval in there, to be honest, because the echo is so bad that I can't hear what they're saying a lot of times. A lot of people are maybe coming off the effects of drug and alcohol, or their mental illnesses of such, they don't enunciate. I just have a hard time hearing, and it echoes so badly, you just can't hear or talk in that cell. The solitary confinement cell is, for lack of a better word, it's just gross. I mean, it seems the mattress is very thin. It's a very small area. I would say people have been detained in there for hours because mental health staff, we're unable to get there, or we can't figure out where to take the person. Usually it's not that we can't get there for the eval. I can get there for the evaluation, but it's trying to figure out where to put the person next, the next step. That can take hours because we need HSC to give us permission or medical clearance. We need to line up transport. We need to get a signature from Terry Sutton. Or if they're not in county, we have to track down the county board chair in another county. And they are in this small room that often it just doesn't seem clean, and that's not the effect of the jailers. They couldn't make it any cleaner. It's just that it's very old, you know. It's very and not sterile, I would say. Yes, sir.
Got a question. Now, what would you do different besides just having a bigger room with? They still have to spend time in a room, would they, before they get through all these procedures?
Well, I can tell you what we did at the safe room, which is still kind of, it's at Serenity Hills. We modeled it after some of Toby's ideas. We made it safe with regard to the toilet, sink, and shower. And then there's a more comfortable bed there with a suicide blanket and a sterile pillow that they can't hurt themselves with. They have a TV.
What's a suicide blanket?
One that doesn't wrap around their neck that they cannot use to do that because it's just too thick. Am I saying that right, Toby?
You can't rip, tear, shred it, or turn it into anything that you can potentially hurt yourself with.
Okay. So it's really a non-suicide blanket, basically. Yeah. Yeah. And then they have access to contact us when they need to. And it's just it's just a more up-to-date environment. And it's bigger, so that if they want to pace around the room, they can do that. If they feel like they're having a mental health crisis and they need to move around, they can move around. Or if they need to sleep, they can sleep, and it's a much more comfortable bed. So it's not just a thin mattress.
Mr. Hunt.
Been mentioned about waiting for judges. Could we add a judge to the staff?
That's a question for the
for the unified judicial system, and so that's that was part of the one of the questions asked by the court consultant of the court administrator, so the Third Circuit or the Third Judicial Circuit court administrator, and how likely is it that we're going to be able to increase staff? So, you know, either be that judges or, you know, court service officers or whatever. And so we, based on that realistic picture, we got a good feel, and most likely that's going to be the court services area, but not much more in the judges is what we're hearing. We did get an increase in the magistrate. We have a full-time magistrate now in Cottington County. So that was probably the major increase that we're going to see for any length of time.
Who makes that decision?
That's at the state level by the unified judicial system. So all the people in the court belong to the state.
Who are justice heated?
Maybe the boss of all that system. Yeah. So that's not. So we just have to dialogue with them through the court administration to make the best, to make our best judgment on how big we should make the facilities. And so we don't want to make it too big if it's not going to do any. If we're never going to have the number of judges to reap the benefit of that. So that's kind of what the debate that we're having.
So we have to have their approval for that.
Yeah, well, it's also legislative too. They have to fund it as well. So, Mr. Mack, you're next.
When you mentioned that a juvenile was held for 6 weeks as the dock was full and things like this, this is going to the same issue. This isn't even about space then. It's about the courts being able to schedule a hearing for this individual is what it amounts to. And I mean,
either way, though, she's still in the jail, and it still takes up a bed, and it still crowds
crowded
facility.
There's no reason for it. I mean,
I think that's a fair. I mean, that's an observation. That's why we don't want to go too large. We're not going to get the judges anyway. So, but at the same time, we have to kind of look into the distant future and say, okay, say 50 years from now. We're going to talk about this a little bit later, but we do have to be ready for that in the distant future. We have to think about future generations.
But as a part of this process, I think it's important that efficiencies are looked for both within the judicial system, the jail, and everything else. It's the same thing if you've got individuals who are waiting to contact an attorney to get bail. They're going to get the bail or whatever, but if the magistrate ain't going to take a call, it's Friday night and they ain't going to take a call until Monday or whatever the heck. You got somebody taking up a bed for 2 days that darn well would make their bail and be out of there. I mean, it's just little efficiencies, but they really
don't. There's process things to be. Yeah, I would agree. And I think that's at least part of this. So you mentioned the case management issue. I mean, that's a process issue where you're beginning to see a way to help somebody, somebody else. So. Mr. Hahn, do you have one more question?
On this judge thing, would a citizen like myself contact the state legislators, senators, representatives?
Would that be
a source of...
Yeah, that would be a good idea. So, but let's hold that on for later on. But that's good, for people's context to understand that issue. Any other questions or comments for Carrie or Sarah, since they were good enough to... and give us an overview of this. One last question I had, just a point of clarification. When you mentioned bed space being full, when you were referring to, and I just didn't catch everything, but you were referring to Yankton and Vera and...
Yeah, Yankton, our state hospital that serves mentally ill population as well as drug and alcohol, they're full. Avera's mental health unit has been full. There's usually a bed wait to get into any kind of rehab center for drug and alcohol purposes.
It's there becomes the overflow by contract, I believe, once Yankton becomes full. And just like Carrie said,
Sioux Falls.
Vera Behavioral.
Mr. Mack,
can we send any to St. Luke's anymore? When I used to be director of social services at the hospital, I know exactly what you're up against. You'd have nonviolent individuals in there who need drug or alcohol treatment. And sometimes, there's a small window to get them to agree to go. And space has always been an issue. And in a lot of cases, if you can get them there, you can avoid them having a criminal incident or another incident down the road. Hopefully, you know, you can address it before they've gotten to some kind of criminal. But I know what she's up against. It's a real nightmare trying to find placements.
And it is hard, because you're right. Sometimes they have to launch treatment, and they have to want it at the right time, or you have to do an IVC, which is a whole other issue. A whole other, it's a long process. IVC, involuntary committal on a person who doesn't want drug or alcohol treatment. That is a long process, too. And so,
very difficult.
It's not just send one. So.
Okay, so you bring this in. Okay, thank you very much, Karen. We're going to sit here and enjoy the rest.
I apologize for being dressed this way. I apologize for being late. I left the game early, but I think they won.
Thank you very much. Oh, no question for Mr. Johnson.
I have one question for Terry. Just listening here tonight, one thing we don't want to do is push them out the door too early. I mean, we want to be very cautious. So, kind of the trickle-down effect is that the counselors or the people that are going to have to track them and follow them after they do leave, we have to be aware of that. That we have enough people to do that. Where is that workforce going to come from? And I don't know if this is part of what we're talking about here, but it is in a way. We're trying to solve one problem by creating more room in the jail, but are we going to create another program or another situation where we don't have enough counselors to crack them?
It definitely is hard to hire master's level clinicians and bring them to Watertown. It's even more hard, if not impossible, we have found, to get a psychiatrist to move here to Watertown. We've got some case managers. I think we could always keep up with the business that would be referred to us. I think that we could do okay with that. I'm not really worried about that. We're always seeking to hire more people too. And we wouldn't hang on to them forever. You hang on to them until they're living in recovery, and then you don't have to provide that day-to-day contact anymore. So that answered your question a little bit. I think we'd be okay. It is psychiatry and also a shortage. That's one of the reasons the HSC is turning people away. They're short staffed with psychiatry, a very short staff with psychiatry. We're always in search of psychiatry. So anybody wants to go back to school, become a psychiatrist. Tell your children.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks. We'll have more questions, I'm sure.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Next thing on the agenda, continuing the discussion of criteria. I think you'll have a slide in your packet there. Hopefully it's legible. This is very close to what was up last week, or last month. The one thing that I added was a couple things. We talked about the need to have some kind of expandability strategy, so that question about how far into the future, beyond that 20 years prediction. So we're asking the court consultant and the jail consultant to map it out 20 years hence, because that's kind of where what's kind of reasonable to do when you're trying to project numbers. But beyond that, we don't want to 20 years from now say, we have to do this all again. So we want to be thinking about what strategies do we have in place. So what I kind of took from last month's discussion was that we want to have something in the plan, physical, something identified for the way we could physically expand a facility if we had to. Yeah, that's kind of the, so that was a screening criterion, something a yes or no that you'd have to do. Okay, that's kind of what I took from that. I mean, this is a draft, this is open to discussion. Then the other thing, I think it was Mr. Mack pointed out that I just didn't annotate the specific parts of the consultant reports for the jail that were pertaining to what we're going to use when we speak to both the size and type of spaces and features and how things are laid out. So efficiency of design is what I'm calling the criterion. So that's basically the changes from last time. So this, you know, we can, what I'm hoping to do is maybe flesh this into a little bit more detail. This is kind of what I'm picturing. I'm open to ideas on this. Kind of flesh this into a little more detail. I appreciate any comments you might have, because you've seen some of these processes. Give it a little bit more detail from our layman's level here, as we, you know, and that's mostly going to be in terms of how we describe the criteria and what we think we need to think about, in other words. And then consider that, make sure we have an idea, at least from our perspective, what the relative importance of each criterion is versus another one. And so one thing we talked about was the aesthetic criteria based on the historical report. You know, do we want to lower that number so it's higher priority, for example? I mean, is that important? So those kind of questions. So if you have any comments or ideas right now, please say so. If not, we'll what I think we need to do is be looking at it and, you know, send me some comment in between now and the next meeting. We can add to it. But so are there any comments, questions from the committee? This woman, please. Does it look like we're kind of on the right track, I guess, is what? So are these things that, and I think in the first go-around, these criteria were there, I think. They weren't necessarily written down, but they were kind of the things the commissioners and the other, you know, it was a bit less of a formal process, but they were kind of, that's kind of what was going on. But this is just an attempt to write it down to make sure we stick to the process and to help us with our transparency a little bit. So, any questions from anybody here about this? Any comment? Okay. Well, this will be for anybody's information. If you want to look at it, it's going to be attached to the minutes online, so it will be draft minutes. So if you want to take another, keep you know, studying it, look at it again. I picture this is going to be more of a document as opposed to a PowerPoint slide with a bit more detail. And then at that point, more experts are going to have to help us flesh this out a little bit better, because we're getting to our layman's limit, I think, for some of this stuff. So, okay. All right, and then if nothing else on that one, I'll move on to the next thing. Okay. We talked a little bit last time about a preliminary RFP. So this is pretty much the same slide as last time, but this time you should have a draft. This is a very rough draft of what an RFP might look like. And again, people's education will be, this will be online, again, as an attachment to the minutes. And it's pretty much outlined as it says here. I was away for a couple weeks, so this is pretty fresh. But this is the draft, so again, we're probably just could be a bit of homework assignment. The one thing we had a little bit of a discussion before the meeting. Let me start at the beginning. This is for pre-design. So this is talking about generating options, asking an architect to generate some options, okay, within some guidelines. The criteria that we just talked about are essentially his, you know, his constraints, the things that keep him focused, plus which another criteria is based on the analysis that Mr. Garnos is doing and that the National Center for State Courts has done, and the discussions we've managed to do on our own, or the historical preservation discussions, and some of the stuff from the police department or HSA or the CSO, those kinds of things that feed into the discussion. Right now, those are mostly recorded in our minutes. So those are things that we'd expect an architect to grasp and to be able to start coming up with solutions that we can think about. And so the question then is, and this is the thing that we need to ponder, is, and within those constraints and expectations, are we going to expect him or her or the corporate or the company, the architectural firm, to deal with specific things? And right now it's pretty loosely worded. If you look at the third page, it says, there's a subheading that says construction options. And it's a little insane. What's the options for uptown and the new site? That's that part of the slide. So it says construction options. So I think this is kind of where the cost could run up. This could affect the cost of what the architect does, because the more options we tell him to prepare, the more work he does, the more it costs us. And so again, and we're not talking about full blueprints here. We're talking about conceptual drawings that allow him to give us a construction cost estimate and an operational cost estimate. Okay, and that's pretty much based on floor space, the type of the floor space. So that's, and that's what we want. And then we can also have something that we can use to bounce off of all those criteria that we that we're talking about. Okay, so then the question, the big question I think is, and I don't want to get into a lot of detail here, is obviously we want an architect to tell us what the possibilities are with the current facilities. Okay, is that, how realistic is that? Document that. Tell us how much it would cost, you know, operationally, construction-wise. And then look at something totally new, what they call the greenfield site in the architecture world, which is kind of what the proposal was going into the November vote last year, so a year ago, this time frame a year ago. Or some other, or maybe some other sites around town that we're thinking of. And so when we start, we probably all hear things like, what about the such and such building? What about doing this or that or the other thing? And so we just got to realize that when we say, okay, we want you to come up with a plan or an option, the more detail they go into for each of those options, the more it's going to cost. And so that's kind of, and we don't want to go into too much detail. It's just going to be conceptual. It's not going to be blueprints. It's not going to be, you know, they're not going to have the HVAC and all that mapped in there. So that's kind of a question to ponder. And I'm not asking for an answer now if anybody has any comment on that. So I think that's kind of the, that's kind of the critical thing that's going to affect this request for proposals. So, any other? 1 second, Mr. Mack. Any questions from the committee? Thoughts? Mr. Corson, looks like he's going to say something. Yes, go ahead, Mr. Corson.
On that, options for uptown and so on, renovation, I think you mentioned some other building or that. If they can, in order to save their time and maybe give them a possibility of what to look at, we as a group or a subcommittee of one or two people or three could look, and I think the building you're referring to is the Bold Midland National Lake building.
That's what I get a lot of questions about.
Yeah. And we should find out, you know, the square footage in it, if it would even be acceptable space-wise for all the county offices that move over there. If it's not, then there isn't really any other alternative. Maybe the auditorium, but I think that's worse than...
Yeah. What, Mr. Bill, have you seen, like, architects do, like, a, like, just a cursory, kind of, like, kind of look at a facility where they could kind of narrow us in without spending all that time. Is that something that you could ask them to do?
Yeah, absolutely. And not only that, but they could tell you what are the things preventing that site or option from being a consideration. Whether it's utilities, whether there's just enough room there, or yes, we could do it here, but we would preclude any options for future expansion if we put it here.
Yeah.
You know, or we could put it here, but we're going to lose a whole bunch of parking and there's nothing we can replace it with. So they can not only identify those things, but tell you what are the impediments to consideration of that site or that facility option. Sometimes there's workaround, sometimes there's not. Yesterday I was in Sioux Falls, and when they were looking at different facility options, a number of them were going to displace 160 parking spots right down by the county administration building. And you can't just say, here's the best place for the jail is on this parking lot, because there's no parking for the courthouse in it now anyhow. So they've had to add a $2.8 million parking ramp to say, if you want to put it here, and this is the best place for it, there's also a premium to be paid for providing the parking that you're going to be removing. And that has to be a consideration, because it's part of the overall project cost. If you can narrow them down, narrow an architectural team down to a certain number of viable options, a specific site, this specific building, or, you know,
yeah.
If you start saying, look at every site, you know, they're going to be chasing their tail.
Yeah. Just off the top of my head before I forget it, what I'm thinking is maybe if we add some language in there to say, possibly look at 2 to 3 more sites, you know, in a cursory way, and then possibly develop those, you know, one or more of those as options. You know,
yep.
You know, buildings to be modified. In other words, you know, they call it a brownfield site.
Yeah.
Where they can modify an existing building. So, you know, but we don't want to, if it's just not realistic, we don't want to spend a lot of time
right.
on it.
So in other words, we should identify what buildings we would want them to look at. Otherwise, they're going to go all over town in that way.
Yeah, well, we could, and I think you may be able to ask, one thing you could add to the RFP, perhaps, maybe a better way to do it, is assistance in determining, you know, viable sites. Okay, and then from that, then you determine a few viable options, say, you know, 3 to 4. Beyond that, I think we're going to be spending,
three or four would be too many.
Yeah, well, ideally we want to keep them down to, like, in the 3 range, I think, if we can. You know, but we want to document, even the cursory glance, we got to document that. We got to write that stuff down and show it in terms of the criteria. Mr. Matt.
I believe, and Bill can sure correct me if I'm wrong, but in Minnehaha County, what they did is they basically put together all the information, the research, what they saw as potential options and so on, and then they presented it out there, and they ended up having, was it 4 or 7 different architectural firms that looked, and they said, listen, price is going to have a factor, but we're not necessarily judging on price. We want to see your best concept to meet these needs of ours. And these are some of the things that we've considered and looked for suggestions. And they basically let them do a presentation and come up with their concept. And then they picked the one that they felt did the best job of meeting all those needs at the best price. And I guess I'd like to see that sort of a process done here.
I'll give you a copy. I'm sure I'll give you a copy of this. But that comes down to the factors that we determine, kind of the bottom here. Understanding of the project requirements based upon the proposal. So that, you know, understanding our situation, getting familiar with our problems, that's the number one thing. And then, you know, price obviously is a big thing, and then, you know, do they have a lot of experience with courthouses and jails? That's going to help too.
One of the other ones that you may want to have in there is future expandability, or things like this is one of your award criteria, you know. I mean, somebody may do a great job of meeting what you need, but the future expandability is going to be difficult. And
I think that's going to be incorporated in the facility options criteria number one. I mean, the criteria we talked about before, but in their experiences and qualifications, we'll want to know how do they address those issues. So, you know, did they address it with, you know, there are different ways to address it. So, okay. Any other issues on the RFP? So what I need for people to do, on the RFP is, please let me know. Take a look at it. I finally put it together.
Is that in one of these papers?
No, this is I did this. This is,
but I mean this up here.
That outline. That slide should be in your slides. But the okay, that outline is essentially the outline of this draft.
Okay,
that's all it is.
This is more outline.
Just because I like slides. And then one more thing on the agenda, then we can cease and desist here. So please take a look at, read through that. It's just a few pages. Read through it. And what you think, and then particularly the language, that maybe some ideas on the language for, you know, getting a cursory glance at some of the sites before they go into to develop an option. So, all right. I think as we're kind of getting closer to this point, we need to make sure that we're not forgetting some of the stuff that we've talked about. We've done this before at the beginning of the process, and. Let's just take a quick look at that. In the self-analysis world, we're working through the stuff, the diversionary programs, the stuff that might present a strategy. You know, if you know our physical strategy for expansion of a facility isn't enough, are there other diversionary programs that we're talking, you know, we've talked about SB 70 and all that stuff, human services. Next month, we're going to try to have the teen court guy here explain that. That's an example of a diversionary program. Are these things realistic ways in which we can, you know, say, okay, this is something we have in our hip pocket, or is ongoing that should help us control the growth of that jail population and the caseload over time? One thing that we probably need to nail down fairly soon, or have an idea before we bring an architect on board, is how long do we want this facility really to last? You know, we're thinking 60 years, 100 years, those kinds of questions. Just have that in our mind preliminarily, and we can have that discussion. I think we should maybe have that discussion next week. And then, of course, bring in any other jurisdictions. So I think we're at a point now where some of the data, particularly the stuff from Mr. Garnos, is going to mean something to other counties when they say, oh, that's my ADP for my inmates for my county. So I've let other commissioners know, other counties know that we're doing this, some of the website link. I've talked to a few of them about it as I've had opportunity. Finalizing our criteria, probably hope to do that maybe by the end of this year. Definitely as we're bringing an architect on board. And then the things that the facility options, particularly identified in the National Center for State Courts report, those are the four things there, kind of the variables in their analysis that we need to think about. So I think we got a good idea of the court reporter issue. The magistrate doesn't really need a court reporter. But then the versatility that I think what we need to, perhaps the way to answer this definitively might be to say, we definitely need the ability to have a second jury deliberation suite, and we need the ability to not have to assemble a jury in a big forum. So those kinds of things we can stipulate. So, okay. Any questions on that? So these are kind of any other outliers, any other things that we're not just kind of, this is kind of going to become a checklist of stuff that we need to make sure we hit. Okay. And then we talked to the law librarian in particular. This is just a Megan Cronin said she would give us a hand, since she is, you know, she can talk to all the lawyers and tell me that pretty easily being from the Chamber of Commerce. But some quick questions there. This is something I just did. So it's not in the slide packet. But a quick survey that we could give to each law firm to say, law library, because we don't want to get ourselves in a corner where we don't have the ability to have even a small library in a new facility.
It can be in the library, right?
It can be.
Anywhere else.
Yeah, depending on the answers to these questions, though, I mean, the public does need access. Well, yeah. A better place for the public access might be the public library. But I haven't talked. We have to talk to the city and everybody.
Doesn't need to be in the courthouse.
I don't. Yeah, the law doesn't. As far as the law goes, as long as it's okay with the judges, it can be outside the courthouse. So the question is, do lawyers who are the ones in the courthouse using these resources regularly, that the gist of these questions is to say, how often do they really need to do that?
I think if you're going to have a law library outside of the county, then you got to get the judge's permission. And I might want to look at that law again.
Okay. I thought it said the person, you know, the circuit judge or something to that effect. So, question on
the problem with. Excuse me, the problem with having the law library in the public library, does that mean that the sheriff's going to now have to transport particular inmates that want to utilize the library?
They have their own, don't they?
What's the legal requirement for inmates?
We have to provide them with any legal books that they need to provide their own defense.
But that's in jail, right?
So we do currently keep all the South Dakota codified law books as well as court administrative rules on file right now.
Okay. In physical copy, hard copy?
Yes.
Okay. So the one thing that, this was Mr. Mag mentioned this at the last meeting, that maybe, you know, if there's a way to share subscriptions with, I don't know if there is, there may not be a way to do it, but, in a future facility or a modified facility, if there's a way to share a subscription, then that might save some space. There's no law, they're functioning without, the courthouse is functioning without a law library right now. So I think either way you're going to have to, that's a good point, but it sounds like you're not going to take an inmate out of his cell and take him to, like, whether the library's in the courthouse or whether it's in the, okay. All right, so I'm going to get with Megan Grumman on these questions and see if they look okay. I mean, they're pretty straightforward. I'll get with her and we'll see if we can get a survey out. It shouldn't take very long to do. So, everybody memorize them? Next meetings, future meetings. I have the 17th of November is the next one. Might be good to take a look at your calendars real quick. I've not scheduled any other visits to a jail. I'm trying to see if I can do one in November, but as the holidays start to approach, it gets a little tougher. But I'll see. Otherwise, we can still be looking at. We can still continue to be looking at the other facilities, even after the holidays. So November 17th is what we have down for the next one. That's still okay with everybody's calendar. And then, what about a meeting in December? I would suggest that perhaps we don't need to meet in December, but I'm looking at about December 15th. So we'll say tentatively December 15th. If we don't need to have that one, we won't. So I appreciate your sticking with us on these long meetings. And so if there's no other business, I'm going to make a motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
A motion to adjourn. So are there any comments from the committee? All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Opposed, say no. We are adjourned. Thank you.